welcome to this week's version of the William Hill Racing Sports Show on ESPN Radio 94.5 FM. Your usual host, Ken Barler, couldn't make it. I believe he's out playing a charity golf function. So this is Josh Nagel filling in. And just in time, I'm joined by a longtime contributor, but we haven't seen him in a while. But he's my co-host today, Mark Shannon. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me, Josh. I appreciate you guys having me on tonight.
So, and John Stevens out of the loop as well. So it'll be Mark and I going over the weekend's events before we hit a holiday weekend here. And there's plenty going on. So, you know, the NBA finals are fast approaching. We've got one set of conference finals still yet to be determined. The Golden State Warriors off their four-game sweep of the Trailblazers lying in wait to take on what either the Milwaukee Bucks or Toronto Raptors coming out of the Eastern Conference. And last night, the Toronto Raptors have completely turned the tables in that series. It was interesting. They were down 2-1. Easily could have been 3-0. They found a way to win game four at home in a blowout. Mark, what do you think? You know, this is kind of funny. I've actually had the Raptors the last two games, and I thought it's almost interesting how quickly perceptions are formed in these series where people just really hold on to the last image they saw. The point being is when the Raptors had home game four down 2-1, and the way Milwaukee had played at home, people just felt like, you know, they were just going to get trounced and bounce out of there really quick. But I kind of had the opposite feeling. Like, if you watch game one, Toronto should have won that. They dominated the whole way, just collapsed. I felt like it easily could have been 2-1 Toronto. And for some reason, the Bucks had that big blowout in game two. Those things happen. And I don't know if it was just in a hurry to see a Bucks-Warriors finals or whatever it was, but to me, it just seemed like the narrative. Like, this was a foregone conclusion. The Bucks just outpaced, you know, the Raptors by a pretty good margin, and that'll be that. I wasn't surprised when Toronto won game four. I will say last night came as a bit of a bigger surprise, but you had, you know, the Bucks laying 7 points, and from what I could tell, it seemed like the entire world just, you know, laid it with Milwaukee like it was nothing. Toronto does get down 17 early, but they come back, made a bunch of huge plays to end up closing out that victory, 105-99. And now, you know, tomorrow night they play for the clinching game at home. It's elimination game six. I will say I'm of the belief that the Bucks have overall talent edge, but when Milwaukee's clicking, I mean, they led the league in victories. They do seem similar to Golden State. I mean, they seem like a fine-tuned machine that's hard to stop when everything's going for them. Toronto's made a lot of adjustments, though, from the first couple games in the way they just basically fly at Giannis onto Antetokounmpo, just refuse to let him take over the game, force it out of his hands, force other guys to make plays. And they can with varying degrees of success, but when you limit them as much as they have and force the role players to beat you, seems like the best strategy anyone's ever come up with. Of course, on the other side, you want to talk about players who really determine the outcome. Kawhi Leonard has been the best closer on either team, and he stepped up big again last night. So I'm just curious, you know, do you think the Raptors close it out tomorrow night? Are you surprised that the about-face this series is done?
Yeah, well, I was a little bit surprised last night. Not that Milwaukee didn't cover, but that they didn't win the game last night. Because, again, I thought they were going to come back with their best effort. Toronto certainly gave their best effort the two games at home and got them. So it's interesting. Let's go back. You said that, you know, Toronto could have won one of those games. Portland could have won one of the first two games at Golden State. Mm-hmm. The difference is they never got the victory, right?
Yeah. Well, it was funny, Mark, in games, well, the last three games, Portland led by 14 or more in all three of them, didn't win a single one.
Right. Wound up covering a couple of them, you know.
Right.
But at the same time, so last night I was a little bit surprised. Again, Kawhi Leonard, you know, you just can't talk about how good he was. Fred VanVleet, I mean, shoot, those guys just shot the heck out of the basketball, right? And you're right. Toronto has said, you know what, we're going to make somebody else beat us. The difference is that Toronto's made some shots and Milwaukee's been unable to make some outside jumpers.
Right. So tomorrow night's game, 5:30 p.m. our time, Toronto game six, 2.5-point favorite, total of 212.5. And historically, you know, they have had trouble closing out. You know, Toronto, that was the old deal against with their previous regime with Kyle Lowry and DeMar DeRozan. It was one of those things where they'd have a great regular season record. For some reason, wouldn't get it done in the playoffs. Often LeBron, you know, had a lot to do with that. Of course, he's out of the conference now. But you saw some of that early on. You know, Toronto even, you know, struggled in the first couple rounds. But they found a way to, you know, make it to this point. It would seem to reason if they don't, you know, close it out tomorrow, again, they'd be in pretty big trouble. But, you know, with everything on the line, yeah, I think it's a tough call because with the way, again, the public especially seems to have short memories of these playoff series, I wouldn't be surprised if they sort of do a reverse now, right? Now they've seen Toronto win a couple, they're finally sold and they jump on them, right? Now it is when it backfires. I think Milwaukee's shown they're capable of winning on the road.
And here's the thing. I took a little bit of today, Milwaukee plus $2 in the series, okay? I know that it, you know, we got to get through game six, of course, and we're on the road. I say we, all of a sudden, I'm a Bucks fan, but at 2-1, I am. So it's 2-1 game series, right? One game at a time. Game seven's back at home, and now all of a sudden, I don't have to lay the 7 points. All I'm looking for is just a home victory. So I took plus $2 today. I don't know if that interests you in any way, Josh. I don't know if you looked at it, but I certainly did that. Going back to Toronto, Nick Nurse has done a heck of a job. My goodness, that guy.
Let me ask you this honest question. Before he became head coach of the Raptors this year, had you heard of him? I hadn't.
Absolutely not. I'd be lying to you, yeah. No. And they've added some other, you know, what, fringe players. Kawhi Leonard, again, I just don't think that we can give the value to him that he deserves. Lowry's been okay.
But they loaded up for that run, the Marc Gasol. Your trade deadline, you're right. They made a few deals to kind of go for it.
Yep.
It looks like it's paying off now. And I'll be honest, I didn't know, you know, a lot about Pascal, Siakam, whatever, until the playoffs either.
Right.
But he seems like he's been, say, a hidden gem, a guy who's an emerging player in the league.
He's going to go in there and battle. He's going to block some shots. He's certainly going to get rebounds offensively and defensively. Yeah. Good enough offensively to make a difference.
Yeah. Who he reminds you of a little bit is like Clint Capella with a little more talent around the basket.
Better offensively.
Right.
Absolutely. The same defensively, the same hops. Again, relentless on the boards, which is what you have to say. Dennis Rodman used to say, the greatest rebounder, said that all you had to do is anticipate every shot being missed. Well, we think about that. Well, that sounds easy. But yet you see players constantly thinking that their teammates are going to make it. How many times have you seen a fast break? They'll just pull up and stop. Dennis Rodman said, I assume every shot is going to be missed, and that's why I'm relentless on the defensive and offensive rebounds.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. One thing I've always appreciated, too, at all levels, is when you see that, especially when it's close to a breakaway or the defender's trailing but probably isn't going to get there. But I've always loved to see when the guy has, you know, something of an uncontested breakaway or close to it but misses, but the teammate scoops it in and you know, lays it back in. Like, now that is the ultimate reward for a hustle play, but that you don't always see being made. But it goes to show that's why you play hard at all times.
Right. It's those little things, right? The 50-50 balls. You hear coaches when they're mic'd up, and I love that that the coaches are mic'd up. You can't get a lot of it in there because some of the language all the times. Steve Kerr is outstanding. You know, Steve Kerr never screams and hollers. He challenges his guys, but he never screams and hollers. Or I shouldn't say during the games, right? I'm sure at the practice facility he certainly does at times. But 50-50 balls, getting on the ground for loose balls, playing defense. I mean, those things have become important. They've always were important, but certainly we've always talked about it during the playoffs. The people that have success, 50-50 balls, playing defense, and being unselfish for your teammates.
Yeah, and you're right. It's interesting what you can pick up with those little tidbits, because I believe a lot of people would be under the impression that since it's the NBA, if you got some close-up look at the huddle, it'd be all some sophisticated basketball jargon that you'd never understand and wouldn't be helpful at all. But it's funny, when you hear about that, same thing with, you know, some of the famous Greg Popovich, you know, blurbs or whatnot, too. When it comes right down to it, they're yelling some of the same things you'd hear in a seventh-grade hall huddle. Get on the floor for loose balls. Box your guy out. You'll be determined that you're going to make the play.
Right.
Things of that nature. They're just, even though it's the highest stakes with the most talented players in the world, it comes down to those core fundamentals. But to play on your point with the series price, for sure, because I see what you're getting at. And by and large, you know, it's kind of a 2-for-1 special on one game. I mean, you could take right now the Bucks on the money line tomorrow is plus 120. Hey, if you like them, you could take that. But you're right, for the plus $2 overlay, I mean, let's face it, Toronto's proven they can win in Milwaukee. Game 7 road teams in the NBA never win. Literally, the stats prove that out. I mean, once in a blue moon. And so you're essentially, they said, getting a two-game parlay for one price payback, and it's pretty good.
And we're not laying the number on Sunday, right? All we're looking for is a home win, just what you talked about. The total last night was the, you know, that thing got bet down yesterday throughout the course of the day, bet down 1-2 points, down a point and a half, went back and forth. The over was never had a chance last night. I mean, the first quarter, they went crazy. The second quarter, third and fourth quarter, it was just buckle down, play defense. And even though they made a tremendous number of threes, if you go back and look, they made a whole bunch of threes, but the rest of the two-point baskets were all being contested. They were late in the shot clock. Every time the ball went out of bounds, I mean, that was part of Milwaukee's undoing, is the last five attempts, I believe, they were at five. They were at under 5 seconds on the shot clock. So not only were they playing the opponent, they were playing the shot clock. And we all know that very rarely, when you're up against the clock and the opponent, you come out successfully. Not very often, anyways.
Right. And in the broader picture, Mark, for NBA championship prices here, I'm checking out off the William Hill U.S. app. Golden State minus 270. I mean, not surprising. The later it goes in the playoffs, there's only three teams left, and their price gets steeper. But most of the year is around minus $2. You could actually argue, you know, given the circumstances, it's a lighter price than you might expect. But of the two remaining ones, so a few days ago when all the rage was on the Bucks, I think they were down to about 2-1. And now that the Raptors have recaptured the lead, it's funny. Again, now's the time to buy the Milwaukee stock if you'd like to, because they've reversed the prices that quickly. Now Milwaukee 6-1, which is indicative, of course, of how bad a trouble they're in the Eastern Conference Finals. But if they were to somehow pull that out, I mean, what do you think, how big of an underdog would they be in the finals to the Warriors? I would just think if there was a time to act for the Bucks to win the whole NBA title, that would be now as well.
Absolutely. I mean, you're not going to get 6-1 going into the finals. We know that, right? And with your point about Golden State, 270, so instead of getting involved in the playoffs and having somebody get hurt, even though Durant got hurt in this situation, but let's just say you lost a more integral part of the team, Steph Curry, Draymond Green, the way he was playing. So 270 is actually cheap, the fact that they've already made it this way, right? Kind of telling you maybe that I don't know that Toronto, in my mind, can beat Golden State. I certainly think Milwaukee can. Their matchup is really, really tough for Golden State.
Yeah, they beat them a couple times this year. Throughout the course of Oakland, yeah, twice.
Well, they play each other just once at home and once, unfortunately. But your point well taken. And I just think that Milwaukee could get after them. Again, matchup-wise, they are going to be trouble for Golden State. I don't know that Toronto can. I probably shouldn't doubt Kawhi Leonard. But if you just look at them, they have to have, I mean, everything go right for Toronto to get there, to me.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's kind of funny how, you know, they always say the transitive math or whatever doesn't make sense, because I felt the same way in the Nuggets-Blazers series. I like what the Nuggets are doing. I think they would have given the Warriors a better series, even though Golden State actually dominated Denver. And it's weird. Golden State split with Portland in the regular season, and I think they won all four games from Denver. But nonetheless, the way they're playing and the way Jokic was coming on, I thought the Nuggets, you know, that just would have been a more compelling series than Toronto. It was basically a great backcourt and still not a whole lot else.
Yeah, we talk about a lot of things on the show. Let's just go back to a week ago Saturday night. Draymond Green might be the most difficult person to officiate in the NBA. I'm an official. I always look at that, right? I mean, he is almost impossible. Every time he goes to the hole, he looks at the official like he got fouled.
Yeah. Anytime, even when it's an uncontested layup, he yells and one at the ref. It's maddening.
Anytime he fouls, there's certainly certain times, obviously, in NBA games that they give fouls. They want to foul, right? Mm-hmm. They stop a fast break. They know that there are teammates behind them, so they don't have the breakaway. Somebody beat them on a spin move, and they know that they still have a foul to give. Draymond Green gives fouls a bunch. Even when he wants to give fouls, he looks at the opponent. I mean, looks at the official and just cannot believe it. Having said all that, last Saturday night, he was unbelievable. He took the Warriors on his back, and everybody that was out on that court, it was like he just told them, if you're going to be on this floor with me tonight, we are going to win this game. I mean, they were down and out to Portland. That was Portland's first home game. I had Portland that night. I thought it was an unbelievable spot. Portland led at the half.
They were up as much as 18, weren't they?
It was incredible. And Draymond Green that night was so good defensively. He was leading the break. We all know that the one thing that is a shortcoming is turnovers. He was leading the break, making the right decisions, passing to the right people. And you say, Mark, the right people? Yeah. I mean, there are times that you don't want to give it to your big guy. He's just going to run over the guy and get a player control foul. I mean, he knew exactly who to give it to. And, again, he just willed them to win last Saturday night. That game, I sat in my living room and just marveled at Draymond Green last Saturday night.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. Actually, I don't know if you saw the press conference as well when Green, I thought, showed some maturity on his part where he acknowledged that, where he even said, like, hey, it got to the point where he said, like, both his mom and his girlfriend were giving him grief over, man, all you do is complain. And he even said, you know, I finally decided to step up because I realized I was whining more than I was playing. That's all. And it's kind of funny because rarely would you hear a pro athlete acknowledge that, but especially the exact phrasing that he used, I said, man, you could have echoed my sentiments more entirely, because there were times where I was watching him the first couple rounds against the Rockets. I'm like, would you just knock it off? Would you just play? Stop, just your whole thing is just centered around the refs. And do you remember last year, I thought it was funny too, do you remember the famous dunk James Harden had on him in the playoffs where there was a reach-in at the free throw line by someone, by Chris Paul, but then he got a continuation and just facial Draymond Green.
Yeah.
And even on that, both guys kind of went to the tumbled to the ground. Draymond took a bit of another cheap shot at him. Then he basically punched Harden in the face as they were tumbling to the ground. And he's still standing on the lane yelling at him. What on earth could he be yelling at the officials about in that specific instance? You know, you're right. Not only is he difficult, but they say that's part of what makes up his persona. But I'm curious if you, like myself, I think the Warriors and how much I like them is, in fact, kind of a moving target. That being without Kevin Durant, I am much more of a fan of them. Meaning, to me, this is the Warriors at the core, which shows everybody just exactly why they didn't need to sign Kevin Durant after, you know, they lost to LeBron once in the finals where they had injuries and Draymond was suspended for a game and all that. They didn't need to go and get him. Yeah, I'm not a big fan of Durant's, you know, general disposition and whatnot, but when you see what they've done, and even in relation to the rest of these teams and how widespread tanking is, what they try to do to just get better, how the Warriors are basically homegrown, drafted Steph Curry, drafted Draymond Green, Klay Thompson, got a couple pieces through, you know, free agency, but by and large, you know, they built from scratch with smart decision-making and things of that nature. And with these guys, as I said, when you see the increased role by Green, when you see Klay Thompson and, you know, Curry back to his MVP caliber form, to me, this is the team that's worth rooting for. Yeah, I'm not a big fan of just, you know, the mega team. Even though Durant is the MVP of the last two finals, I like this version better.
Yeah, well, you're going to get your wish, Josh, because he's certainly not going to re-sign next year. Okay, I mean, he's going to go to New York or the Wizards or wherever he's going for a bunch of money. My buddy says, hey, as soon as he gets to the Knicks next year, Mark, I want you to bet, you know, we're going to take Durant to lead the league in scoring, because he just thinks he's going to go out and get his, you know, with nobody else around him. And certainly he can do that. I mean, he certainly can score. There's no question about that. Make the threes, get to the basket, great free throw shooter. I just could not believe a couple weeks ago when you guys gave out the stat that the Warriors were 26-1 without him.
Yeah, now it's up to like 30-1. Yeah.
Absolutely. They haven't lost since, okay? So it's only increased. I mean, I was absolutely – I knew that they had – you know, a way above 500, I never would have guessed that. You could have given me three multiple choices, and I would have lost money because I would have never got that correct.
And, you know, it's completely reversed, too, when it's the other way around. When Curry's out and only Durant plays, they're like 500 or below. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it's crazy. That statistic is really telling, too, because it's far from, like, just a tiny little sample. I mean, there's a lot of games on both sides.
Yeah, plenty of games. You're right. That's not a six-game sample. That's not a 10-game sample. That's not even a 20. I mean, there are plenty of games to show what happens there. Golden State is just – they're fascinating. I mean, they are the one team in the NBA that's willing to share the basketball. A lot of teams, as soon as some guy hits three or four shots, everyone else says, I got to get mine. And Golden State is willing to go back to Klay Thompson, to Steph Curry. They'll do it with Kevin Durant. They're the best at sharing the basketball in the entire league. I mean, nobody else does it like that, and they reap the rewards because of that.
All right. Well, we're going to head off to our first commercial break here. Please join us again in just a minute. William Hill Sports Show, ESPN Radio, 94.5 FM.
Now, back to the William Hill Sports Show, live from the William Hill Sportsbook inside the Club Cal Neva.
All right, welcome back to the William Hill Sports Show, ESPN 94.5 FM. Again, Josh Nagel filling in for Ken Barler, along with Mark Shannon, taking you through this weekend's games and various other sports betting-related topics. Before the break, we went over, you know, the NBA Eastern Conference Finals between the Bucks and Raptors. Again, tomorrow night, Game 6 for the Raptors at home, a closeout opportunity against the Bucks. They're 2.5-point favorites, over-under of 212.5, and the winner of this series will meet the Warriors starting next Thursday in the NBA Finals, as the Warriors will attempt to three-peat, fourth possible championship in the last 5 years. But, Mark, so I believe I took for granted before we got to the break, do you have a play just on the game tomorrow night?
Again, I got the Bucks in the series now. I've got the Bucks at 6-1 to, you know, win the whole thing. So I'm on the Bucks, but not tomorrow night. Again, Josh, I would say that total certainly got bet down again, you know, and they're starting it lower tomorrow. I think the same thing is going to happen. I think the game stays under again tomorrow night. They may get off to a fast start like they did, but I know that when it comes time to, they're going to buckle down and play defense.
All right, sounds good. And, again, Golden State's minus 270 to win it all. And if you somehow aren't opposed, you know, to laying that kind of chalk, no matter who they face in the finals, that price is just, you're bound to get steeper. So that might be something you could, you know, act on now if you like Golden State.
If you're looking, you know, if you think the Raptors are going to win, I would think that they're going to wind up playing, laying. What's Golden State going to lay against the Raptors? 450? So, I mean,
at least.
So I think you're getting it cheap if you think the Raptors are going to win. Josh, I think the books, sometimes, you know, we always say the bookie will tell us the answer. And I think this case, they think Milwaukee's coming back. The fact that it's only 2-1. The Golden State's only minus 270 for the series. And I say only. I know that people are going only. I know that's a huge number. But I just think, again, against both those people, against Toronto, it's going to be way bigger than minus 270. There's no question about that.
You know, I'm curious, because we don't have it now, but you know how they update the prices after each and every game after Milwaukee survived Game 1 with a blew them out in Game 2. I wonder what the series price was then. So that makes me wish I had a little something on the Raptors. But you had to be super steep. Right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so what were they going into the series? Do you remember?
I think it was like, yeah, I believe it was minus 270 on Milwaukee and plus 230 on Toronto.
Okay, so they're going to double.
Yeah, they had the home court edge.
Yeah, so they're already up 2-0. They're going to make them minus $8
yeah,
for the series?
I think Toronto was plus 6 after the first
So I'd say the Bucks minus 8 and Toronto plus 6,
right.
Yeah. And if you had that spot, man, so now you got Toronto plus 6-1. You could have the Bucks plus 2-1. And, again, we always talk about it, having the app. I mean, now you are not a loser, right? You're either getting you're rooting for the Toronto at plus 6-1, obviously. But if they don't, 2-1's not a bad thing to have either.
Exactly. Even if you just took them before the series, you'd be all right. There's nothing better than that plus sign on both sides of the equations. If you had a decent bet on Toronto plus 230 and Milwaukee plus $2, it's a good feeling, in the betting circles when you literally can't lose.
And that happens in baseball, Josh, on the app. So if the game goes tight, a perfect example, yesterday the Giants and the Braves go to extra innings. So, of course, it comes to the, let's just say, the top of the 10th. Now the Braves are up, so the Giants are going to be a slight dog, even though they're at home, right? As soon as it goes to the bottom of the 10th, Atlanta's a slight dog. Well, if you do that 10th, 11th inning, I mean, you're getting plus money both times. Now, after that, you just sit back, like you said. You don't even care who wins because you're plus-plus both sides.
Yeah, exactly. Like I said, in-game, we see it in the NBA, but similar with baseball, and it's pretty insane. Like, you could take, like you said, a pretty steep favorite, but if they fall behind 2-0 in the first inning or whatever, suddenly your minus $2 favorite becomes a $2 underdog with 8 innings left to play. Those opportunities abound. So you're right, if you haven't got the William Hill US app, I mean, that's the way to go for in-game opportunities that allow for a lot of profitable setups on both sides. But, Mark, since you're here, I want to mention something, get your take on officiating in general. It's interesting because when Ken's here, the other guys, it's been a topic we've brought up. I know I've really addressed it a few times, but just in the sense that we're seeing more and more these days dynamics of officiating that I don't think anyone else used to pay attention to, but just interesting with the technology and the zoom-in angles you get on every single play and the replays that are allowed toward the end of the game and things of that nature and the technology world we live in, all these things come to light more so than ever before, particularly with regard to the basic concepts of shooters and their landing zones and things of that nature. Of course, we saw a big thing with it happening in the NCAA tournament, right? So many games that came down to the wire. Tennessee, Purdue, I said that was the first kind of controversial one, and I'll say at the time I was upset only because I had Tennessee, to win the game or minus 1.5 points. They foul Carson Edwards of Purdue on a three-pointer. He makes two, sends it to overtime, and Purdue wins. I didn't like it just because I wanted to see the game end, but then the more replays I saw, I was like, you can't ignore that. He took a pretty good shot. Like, he actually got the shot off cleanly, but took a pretty good blow on the way down. And then, of course, in the Final Four with Kyle Guy of Virginia against Auburn when they threw it to him in the corner. And same thing, the more angles I actually see of that, and I've seen since, he was clearly bumped. I think that's something you can't ignore. But you always hear, the old cliche that, the refs, you don't want them deciding the game. But I've also been on the other side of, not calling a foul on somebody who clearly gains a disadvantage by being bumped. That's also them deciding the game. But the reason I bring it all into perspective here is because our listeners aren't aware. Mark Shannon's a well-experienced local official who does a lot of games. I've seen him calling at the local high school, does high-level varsity and some college, and I used to do some myself. It's been a long time, but I used to do some high school varsity myself. So having come from that background, I think I take a bit of a different perspective, as long as you might, in terms of, from the official's point of view and also just the basic, concept of fairness and what is and isn't a foul. But I'm wondering from your perspective, so you're out there, you officiate the games, and I know you've heard and seen just about everything on the court yourself, but when you see these games, college and pro, and then just the aftermath where there's these calls and whoever's a fan of the losing team just, blames the ref all over Twitter and social media. And you see commentaries that it's ruining the game, with all the replays. I mean, where do you think, we stand with all this in terms of, to apply it to the NBA, that wild game one with the Rockets and Warriors where it just seemed like every three-pointer that came up, it didn't even matter if it went in or not. Whoever missed the shot was looking at the official and they just complained. And that I thought that game just turned into, a circus show. But with the attention, that's paid to it, I mean, do you think, officials are on the right side of it most of the time? And do you believe that, technology is the main reason we're seeing such an increased focus on this?
So let's start off with the very premise, all right? officials work really, really hard to get to where they're at. I mean, the NBA just doesn't come out and watch a guy for a day and say, hey, you know what? That guy can officiate in the NBA. I mean, they spend years. When the Bighorns were here, I used to keep score occasionally whenever Nevada was at home and the Bighorns were at home. We used to keep the clock over there, right? Fast-paced game, tremendous game. Those guys put years in. They travel each and every night. Those D-League guys don't get paid very much. And they're going from city to city. And you talk about the old thing in baseball where the bus rides and all that.
Yeah. So you're right. It's kind of like the players where they're, you know, barely making a real living.
Right. So the officials put in a lot of time. They go to camps. They get judged on each and every play. They get followed. I mean, they make sure that they're not in any betting circles, right? They're not affiliated with anybody who goes to any type of betting situations. Now, I know that there's been certain situations with Tim Donaghy, obviously, okay? That's a black eye that the NBA will have forever. They certainly didn't like that.
Hey, what do you think, Mark, by the way, before you get going on that? Because I thought that's a big milestone in the whole, you know, tied with NBA officiating where it is now. But I believe in hindsight, that was one of the best things that could have ever happened to the NBA. Because now with the two-minute report, things of that nature, they're so sensitive to transparency and coming out and admitting when they're wrong. And I'll admit, I was of the belief, not the NBA, you know, rigged per se, because I think that word is thrown out there so loosely, but there are times where I couldn't believe some of the things that looked, I say, borderline orchestrated. But one thing Donaghy brought to light in his book that he wrote where he tried to, you know, sell everyone out, I don't know if I ever said this to you, but remember the famous Lakers King series in 2002 where people were just up in arms about the officiating? One thing Donaghy asserted in his book that the NBA didn't deny, I've always just thought was just astounding to me, is that before Game 7 of that series in Sacramento, that the NBA had some high-ranking executive come into the officials' locker room and tell them the points of emphasis that they needed to pay attention to in Game 7. And as you just mentioned, I'm like, are these guys not already the best in their profession at the top of their game? Do they really need to be told what to do? Are these points of emphasis not other than, yeah, watch the contact when Kobe drives in there with a wink and a nod? If that's not the closest thing to manufacturing an outcome or the NBA admitting that it was once rigged, I was just astounded when the NBA admitted that that happened. And to me, the fallout from the Donaghy thing is beautiful because, like I said, I used to be afraid to bet NBA games because it did seem to me it didn't matter. If the NBA had a home superstar, Kobe Bryant, you name it, who got all the calls, I mean, I just feel like in the past few years, you're seeing much cleaner results in terms of the officiating, meaning the road team wins once in a while. You see calls go both ways, but occasionally you will see that charge go against the home team in the last 2 minutes. And I feel like it's really cleaned it up, but how do you feel on that commentary?
Yeah, well, the two-minute report I love, you know. And again, guys are trying to get plays right all night, you know, the entire night. So the NBA, there's three officials at work. Before they ever leave that night, they have to write a report back, okay? The first half, when they go in at halftime, they can ask for any number of plays that they want to look at. So you and I come together on a timeout, and we say, you say, hey, Mark, that player control foul that you had on, you know, why did you make that? So at halftime, they go in, and they actually look at the video. There's a person that's assigned to them that brings them the video of the whole first half. They look at, maybe you want to look at three plays. I want to look at three plays. Our partner wants to look at three plays. So they look at nine plays in the first half. Again, they're held at the highest accountability, you know, all the time. So, I mean, I love the two-minute report. And again,
just, but what do you think about the critics of the two-minute report say, well, you're just setting teams up. You're just giving them the green light to justifiably blame officials when it comes out, when they release that thing and say, yeah, you know what? James Harden did get hit on that last shot, and yeah, you know what, Steph Curry should have fouled out. You see, we told you so. Blame the ref. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
That's the lynch mob get a hold on the refs. But I think it beats the alternative. Coming out and say we were wrong, it beats the alternative of just, oh, no, we'll just let you believe it's rigged.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, so the fact that they bring it up, the team that had it happen against them, they know what went wrong anyways, right? They know that Steph Curry committed a foul and it didn't get called. They know that James Harden got hit. So all this does is, as you said, it makes it transparent. I love that, okay? I like Adam Silver. I think he's done a tremendous job. And you talk about a betting-friendly commissioner. I mean, there's nobody more betting-friendly in any sport than Adam Silver.
Except for the part about him trying to take the $1 dignity tax or whatever. Yeah, good luck with that.
But the point being that you're bringing up is that, listen, again, guys are trying to get calls right the entire time, just like players are trying to make the best plays. If we were to go watch every basketball game, you see people, Steph Curry makes poor decisions all the time. Now, he's going to come back and make a good decision. The officials are going up and down that court as fast as the players, trying to be out in front of them. I mean, these guys are more athletic. We talk about it all the time, right? every player that's playing. There's a huge tournament up here this weekend, an AAU tournament, each and every year out at the convention center. And there'll be more athleticism in that thing all the way from second and third grade all the way up to varsity basketball. I mean, players are just getting better. They're getting faster. They jump higher. So the officials, they're trying to be in better shape. They're trying to do things better. They're trying to watch their soul area and be better at it. I mean, that's what people do, you know. That's the challenge. That's why people love to officiate, because, again, they're trying to get better and be on top of their craft, even though these players are getting better each and every day, all of them.
Yeah. What do you think? Is that specific thing something that's evolved over time? For instance, let's just say you're the three-point shooter and his, you know, landing area, and you're right. In real time, it's hard. I've even watched – you mentioned the D-League, and let's face it, a lot of those guys, Jeremy Lin, I mean, they're NBA quality. It's the AAA of basketball. They're NBA quality players. Many of them are. I've watched that from close up before, and wow, I wondered how the officials, I mean, again, such a fast-paced game, and you see a guy drive in there, and it's just, as you know, breakneck pace, where a guy might come in, and suddenly the ball squirts out, and you know, did he get hacked, did he not? And the official right there has to, you know, make the call in just a lightning split second. I've always had respect for the difficulty and the speed of the game that takes to comprehend. But when it comes to this dynamic we're seeing all the time with shooters in their area, I mean, do you think, you know, but by and large, you know, is the NBA, you know, on the right, you know, path with that? I mean, are you seeing it called correctly more often than that?
Yeah, I mean, they have their specific rules for that, right? And just like we talk about in football, again, I'm a big underplayer, right? I've mentioned that a bunch of times. The NFL has gone to what? I would say they've gone to the offense, right? They are happy with the pass interference calls. And, again, that's a huge penalty to me. They go put it at the spot of the foul. I mean, that's huge sometimes. It's 40, 50, 65 yards. It's incredible. The three-point shooter, again, these guys are getting smarter and smarter all the time. James Harden's the one that brought it to light, forcing himself, going through people. A couple years ago, of course, they've come back to now he wasn't in the act of shooting. He was on the ground because he was gathering. I mean, they've done a bunch of things, and these officials get new regulations, new rules all the time. So do they call it most of the time correct? Unequivocally, absolutely they do. But the offense, again, they're just putting more pressure on them, right? And we know the old school used to be that if you jumped into as an offensive player into the defender, you'd never get that call. Now sometimes that's a 50-50 call. Sometimes the offense gets the benefit of it.
Right, no, I agree with that. Sometimes I think it's gone too far the other way around, but that's a question I wanted to ask you maybe, you know, the next segment here. But just when it comes down to, you know, some of the basic stuff we saw. So, for instance, the Final Four, Auburn against Virginia. I mean, same way. I mean, I was rooting for Virginia. I loved the story. You know, they went from first number one seed to lose to 16 to win it all. I thought it was great. I was actually a little bummed out when it looked like they were going to lose to Auburn.
Yeah.
When the play happened in real time, though, it's kind of funny. You know, they threw the ball to guy in the corner. He shoots it. And even – apparently the PA announcer, you know, said Auburn won over the airwaves and people were going nuts. But even watching the broadcast, though, I heard the whistle. I knew what was going on instantly. I heard the whistle. I'm like, oh, they're giving him three shots. And, of course, there was a lot of debate about that. But just in the most basic sense, when there used to be, again, we both know it's unwritten because no official was ever instructed to say, you know, don't call a foul on the final play. But when you see that, I mean, you feel like, you know, it was justifiable. I mean, he got free throws that were coming to him. If you're standing there, it would have been a bigger mistake to let that go.
Oh, absolutely. And again, there's always one side that's happy, right? So if you don't make that call, wouldn't the other side say, hey, that game got taken away from us, just like you're describing? I mean, the fact that only one team seems to say, oh, we're upset. Well, if that happened against you, you'd be upset on the other side. And I thought both those fouls, as you talked about, the Auburn-Tennessee and then the Tennessee-Purdue and certainly Auburn and
Virginia.
Virginia, thank you. I those were clearly fouls. Again, right. Why would the defender go jumping out 6 feet? Do what we always were taught to do. Go close out with your hand up. Make it difficult. There's just sometimes that players, and these guys, again, have gotten so good, so they practice so often. They take so many jump shots a day. There's going to be some times that they make a shot over a defender. Sometimes you have to tip your cap. But why would you foul them and make it easy?
Right. I'm also curious in that sequence, too, like Auburn, why did there's a concept of having to foul to give. I've never understood why they feel like it's mandatory to take it. You know, they gave Virginia a free timeout at midcourt with 1.5 seconds left. They're going to have nothing but a heave, and you foul them and let them set up that play.
right,
and get an open shot in the corner.
And that's an interesting theory. You know, you go back and forth on that, the three-pointer, whether you got your foul to give, like you said. I mean, it all comes down to different situations, right? In that case, there was no timeout. I'm with you. Why would you give them a timeout in that situation? I can't stand the replay, and we'll go on after this break about that. But there's a lot of times that NBA teams are out of timeouts, but because they go check – Who's it off of?
Yeah, for 5 minutes. That's another drawback.
My,
of the
my goodness, they get to have the whole thing free, for lack of a better term. And I'm using quotes, but people at home can't see that. So you get a free timeout just to go look at a routine play sometimes.
Right, right. Well, we're going to go off to our next commercial break. We have more basketball rules discussion in just a minute. William Hill Radio Show, ESPN 94.5 FM.
Now, back to the William Hill Sports Show, live from the William Hill Sportsbook inside the Club Cal Neva.
All right, welcome back to the William Hill Sports Show, ESPN 94.5 FM. Again, Josh Daigle with Mark Shannon here. And before the break, we're talking a little bit about some of the transitions we've seen in basketball and officiating over the past several years at both the college and pro level. We mentioned it specifically because Mark Shannon, I mentioned, is a documented successful local official here, and he's seen just about everything on the court.
That's up for debate, Josh. There'd be
yeah,
some
I've
people
seen
that...
you, man. I've seen you call right. freshman and JV games like a pro. I'm dead serious. That's right. The sign of a professional official. When you call that game as you would a college game with the same, you know, professionalism at any level, and I've firsthand witnessed that. So I will, you know, vouch for your credibility right here. But one thing I mentioned to you, you know, before the show, a little during our breaks is, and this doesn't happen overnight, but there's been almost a complete climate change in how basketball is officiated in terms of, you know, what's a foul, what's not. I find it fascinating in ways. I bring this up on a couple levels. One, the other night I was watching, you know, the Celtics versus Lakers, 30 for 30. And you've seen some of the bad boys and stuff. And to me, it's funny. It's not that long ago, especially, well, so if you want to go mid-80s, but even through the Detroit phase, through the early 90s, what used to be, you know, a foul and what wasn't, and some of it, I mean, you look back at some of the highlights, I just find it borderline comical. Where, I mean, Detroit, for instance, they weren't goofing around. Lambert and those guys were, yeah, you went in and you could just expect to get hurt. You know, a good player on another team drives the lane, and you would see things where basically, you know, one guy clotheslines him, the other guy takes his legs out, and the guy's just, you know, be assault if it happened, you know, outside the arena. It was just nothing. It was a two-shot foul, and they played. There wasn't this flagrant one, two. Let's suspend him. Let's see. Oh, it's not. It's excessive force and all that. It was just a standard thing. But that's also why you saw scores. I mean, it was why it was rugged. Oh, I even believe, you know, the hand and hip check, whatever, is basically allowed. And talk about how freedom of movement is a point of emphasis these days, which I actually like. I like freedom of movement, but I also don't like the fact where it's basically, you know, the equivalent of two-hand touch football and basketball. I mean, you just can't touch anybody. And sometimes I wonder if we've gone to opposite extremes. So that old-school NBA, where, like, you saw scores in the 80s was not uncommon. Now, I mean, people are wondering if you don't break 100 every game, you know, you had an awful offensive output because it's all geared toward, except freedom of movement, shots being, you know, more or less uncontested. It seems like the NBA, all you're really allowed to do is, you know, sort of, you know, get a hand up, and that's about it. But on the college level as well, Mark, I was watching some retro, like some late 80s, early 90s Final Four games a couple of weeks ago. I thought the same thing, how it used to be, the rule seems, I don't want to say, you know, tilted toward the offensive player, but at least, you know, enforced that way. Whereas when there was something, you know, block charge is always the greatest, you know, dynamic that officials are taught, you know, to look for, and principle of verticality is emphasized, things of that nature. But it used to be if a guy went inside, and you're right, just a pump fake, hey, if the defender just kind of bit on the pump fake, didn't matter if he was straight up or not, that's two shots. If they bumped into your jersey, you know, if he blew on you, that was a foul. Player control was a pretty rare thing to see. And it seems like we've done such an about-face, though. It's interesting. Now they say, you know, the defender has these rights. No, even if they jump, as long as they're straight up, if you initiate, it might be on you. And I don't know if you've done this. One thing I'll say from my own officiating experience, I always found awkward. And sometimes you felt kind of compelled to make a call. But the awkward-looking play, it just makes you feel weird. When, like, a guy goes in and just flails, and three guys hit the floor, you felt like you had to call something. And you felt weird just, you know, letting that go. But I'm willing to admit, the times I officiate, sometimes, you know, more often than not, if it's one of those you feel like you have to call something, usually it'd be a foul on the defense. But now we're seeing, you know, those basic concepts really challenged and sometimes flipped on their head. And I think from what I've watched, and I want to get your perspective on this, but both on the college and pro level, I mean, now we're so trigger happy on the offensive foul. I think it's crazy because I was favoring basketball. You know, a little swim move. I mean, and when you're taught to play basketball, the first thing you're taught is with your offhand to protect it so someone just can't reach in there. So to me, when you see the perimeter, a basic play, a guy starts a swim move or he just starts to spin or do something, and the guy does a soccer flop, and the amount of charges we see called, I'm not a big fan of that. But conversely, one thing I've noticed particularly, you know, in the paint, and how they're trying to give the defender more leeway on this. I've seen the offensive player get in the lane, you know, they're driving and trying to make a bucket. It just seems to me that these days an awful lot of contact is let go because they say, oh, yeah, it was clean up top and stuff. Yeah, and I get that, but sometimes what about the hip check that sent the guy into the stands? And they're running the other way with it. I mean, seriously, especially when you see the slow-mo replay. Oh, I thought, man, have we gone too far with that? Where I think on the perimeter we're seeing – I think we're getting, you know, way too sensitive with the – with the charges, but in the paint, I'm starting to think a lot of contacts being let go. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, a couple things. Let's go back to where you said they used to clothesline them, and they literally and figuratively did all that, right? Now, as you said, they immediately go to the camera, they go to the replay, they put this flagrant two on them, flagrant one. I mean, Kevin McHale would laugh at today, right? If he were out there playing and he does some announcing, right. And all those guys from the old school, every one of them say, oh, my goodness, let's play on. I mean, all of them, because that's the time and age that they were brought up in. So it's so funny. The quarterbacks from the 1970s and 80s, the 90s, these guys got to be laughing, right, at these guys nowadays. I mean, you talk about two-hands touch and flag football. I mean, these quarterbacks used to get hit helmet to helmet in the day that they knew that it was bad for him, but they didn't know what it is now.
Yeah, have you seen some of the highlights, like in the 50s? It was like Chuck Bednarik. They decapitate quarterbacks. It was hailed for it.
Right. You know, I mean, again, the quarterbacks have to just be – now, my God, they went through all this stuff to get it for the guys today. Has it made the game better? Yeah, of course, absolutely. So all those plays that you're talking about. On the perimeter, again, let's just talk about first thing that – so the offensive player can always have – his hand, arm, shielding the ball, right? It's just that they can't make contact. So as me as a defender, I get up in, let's say, your space. I get up, I'm in a legal guarding position, and that's the word you're looking for. If you do anything to fend me off or push me away, then that can be called against the offense. If there's no contact by the defense, then both of you can be as close together as humanly possible without any contact. Therefore, there's no foul. As far as going down the middle nowadays, yeah, maybe we've swung it back a little bit, and you're right. So while it's up top is clean, you can certainly take someone's balance off hitting them at the hip. You can hit somebody in the leg and take their balance off and put them in a dangerous position. So you certainly bring up a valid point there. The great thing is that we have gotten better at all those things. As you said, the defender can jump in the air, and for people out there right now, sorry to bore you with some of the details, but my hand, my verticality, I can go all the way to the roof, straight up and down. So while I can jump, I can't jump into the offensive player and make contact and, again, create that disadvantage, put them off balance. But I certainly have my entitlement going straight up and down, just like the offensive player can't get me up in the air, jump into me, and then go to the free throw line, which for several years a lot of people made a great living off of doing, right?
Yeah, it was just automatic. Yeah, one thing, let me ask you this but also about rule changes, because I saw an interesting interview with Tony Bennett, the Virginia coach. I thought it was fascinating because this was actually before the NCAA tournament. It was during the ACC tournament. It was this roundtable chat. And they said, oh, we're just interview the coaches on a variety of topics. And they brought up the officiating to him. I thought he was dead on with his analysis of it, too, where they said things of, you know, he said, you know, in a lot of ways, it seems like the college game is really starting to reflect the NBA game and the way it's officiating, the rules have been implemented. He goes, you know, I'm not a big fan of that. He goes, because they're supposed to be different. There are things that are just, you know, not supposed to be the same. And the closer, you know, you get to just making it sort of a, you know, NBA rehearsal, he's like, it kind of takes away from the authenticity of the college game. And I agreed with what he was saying. I think a lot of it, you know, had to do with that in terms of the block charge. But some of the other stuff that's thrown in there, and the main point I was going to bring is the restricted area, I think, is the worst idea basketball has ever had. I mean, at first it was introduced in the NBA, and now college. I'm like, and on what planet is it illegal to play defense? Oh, yeah, go ahead and play defense anywhere except near the hoop. And once you get here, it's Olay time. You better let them in. And not, as you must know as an official, too, not like the home plate umpire in baseball, those strikes are great. You got to see if it, you know, crossed the plate and if it had the correct height versus his numbers to the knees and all that. I mean, that's difficult enough. Now you see these blocked charge calls. I'm convinced it skews the principle of verticality so much as just where was his feet. Now you got to pay attention to both. Was he set and was he outside the line? I just think they need to wipe that away entirely. I mean, I think a defense in a basic sense needs to be permitted in basketball.
Yeah, well, a couple things. First of all, Tony Bennett is an absolute gentleman, and he's one of my big fans. What a great night that night, him against Virginia against Texas Tech. Him and Chris Beard coaching, and that's what they literally did was coach, right? I mean, it was so great. Chris Beard said one thing to the officials the entire night. Tony Bennett said nothing to the officials. Both of them were on their team trying to get the best out of them, trying to get them in the right spot. So it was great to watch those two guys have success. Because, again, anyone who's officiated, and that's you and I both, you know that when you're just left alone and able to officiate, you're going to do a better job. If I'm not distracted by a coach, by a player constantly, by coaches, I'm going to be able to do a much better job. And those guys realize that. So that's, I want to bring that point up. So everything that's been changed in the college game has been done so by the coaches. Okay, they've taken their surveys, and those coaches have said, here's what we want to put in. So they're the ones that first brought it up. Now, to do, I love your point where you said, play defense all over the court, and then when you get to the basket, let them go. I mean, because that's what it appears to some people, right? That you can do it everywhere on the floor except when you get near the hoop, which, of course, is what you're ultimately trying to defend. And that might be part of the reason why some of that other contact is being able to happen because, again, the official has to look at the feet to make sure that the feet are set outside the restricted area. And that's why maybe some of that at the hip area, again. But all those changes have been put in because that's what the coaches want. So they get a big vote on that. They're the ones that wanted that freedom of movement. They thought that their guards were just being manhandled out front and weren't able to get to the right spot in order to set up their offense.
All right, fair enough. We'll be right back after a quick break. Join us again, ESPN Radio Show 94.5 FM.
Now back to the William Hill Sports Show, live from the William Hill Sportsbook inside the Club Cal Neva.
All right, welcome back to the William Hill Sports Show on ESPN 94.5 FM. And Josh Nagel and Mark Shannon with you today. And before the break, we're talking about some of the recent officiating changes and trends we've seen and basically points of emphasis and new rules a bit introduced. And we're talking because, again, Mark officiates local basketball here. I was curious to get his perspective because when Ken and all the other guys are here, we've had some debates about this on every level. But, Mark, just before the break, I had to ask you, again, about what was my biggest beef with the new officiating era, so to speak, and that is the restricted area. Some of the other stuff I'm in favor of, though, like hand checks or lack thereof. Like I say, from some of the competitive basketball that I've played, things of that nature. Oh, that's frustrating as anything. If a guy is legally allowed to put his hand on his hip and he's a physical guy, you can't really do anything. So I like getting rid of that. I like the fact that the defense has more of a chance to where, a charge isn't such a, a foreign concept and you see it more often. I wondered, did we take the finesse side of things too far? But with the restricted area specifically, and you're well aware of this, with the NBA especially, that's another thing in the last 2 minutes. And suddenly, we're replaying. It's almost like, the running back crossing the goal line, did he or did he not? And now we can see where his feet completely outside. And even if they weren't, but if his foot's, if his foot's just barely on the line, even if he was there for 5 seconds, suddenly it's, it's a chart or a block on him instead of the appropriate call being a charge. So in many ways, I feel like, the NBA by design is more or less just legislated defense out completely, because they want to see 125 to 119 every game. They're completely, I'm in favor of seeing the best players in the world unleash their offensive skills in a finesse fashion as well, probably not to that degree. But as an official, let me just ask you, if you had your way, are you in favor of restricted area, or would you wipe it out?
Yeah, I would not have it there, but I understand, like I said, why they did it. And again, all these coaches, they're the ones that wanted that change. But yeah, I wouldn't do that. It's just one more thing that they have to worry about. And the more you have to worry about, the less you can officiate and the more you're spending your time focusing on that. So again, I'm with you. I would wipe that out. Certainly the hand check, you brought that up. I mean, when you get somebody that's strong in the forearm, they can take and guide you wherever they want. So as you said, that was really, really good. They literally just took point guards and people up top and even down low. If you had somebody that was very strong, they just took you to where they wanted you to go.
You're exactly right. And if you were the physically inferior player, there was nothing you could do about it. Like, there was no getting around them.
Yeah, you had no chance. And so, again, like all these things, there's been some good, there's been some bad. I just can't stand the replays, okay? When you have to slow it down to the milliliter to find this thing on a tip ball out of bounds, and then the official gets it right 92% of the time anyways, I mean, my goodness, we talked about it before. You get that free timeout. It takes – so they want all this flow to the offense, right? And meanwhile, we're watching a replay for 3.5 minutes, and it's taking all the flow out of the basketball
game. What do you think, for instance, you mentioned that, like the famous one now, again, just talking very recent examples, but the Texas Tech-Virginia one that was more or less absent controversy, but except that play that was called where – you know, they replayed it forever where the Texas Tech kid was going on a semi-fast break. I think DeAndre Hunter caught up with him from behind, tried to swipe it. It was just microfibers, you know, off his fingernails, and they reversed it and gave it back to Virginia. You'd rather see that, you know, wiped out.
Yeah, again, I mean, these guys, it's all about the human element, right? So we're, you know, they take, I think one of these days, I mean, I'm going to hate it, but they're going to have some robot calling balls and strikes. They've talked about it. They've, you know, they do it at the tennis matches, right? When the ball's out by a 32nd of an inch or an 80th of an inch, whatever they boil it down to. I mean, for years it's been done just by the naked eye. Again, these guys are in the right spot. They see tip balls the majority of the time. Now, if something happens, I mean, how many times have we seen, oh, it's going to be Blues team ball out of bounds? And we go to the break thinking, absolutely, unequivocally. But, again, they got to come down and slow it down to so many frames. That's the part that really bothers me. You don't like the restricted circle? I mean, I just can't stand it that you have to slow it down so often, so far. And then, like I said, the majority of the time they get it right, okay? But you talk about taking the flow out of the game. So all these things that they want to do, but they think it's okay for the last 2 minutes because it's critical. Well, some coaches will tell you that when they don't have the ball out of bounds at, 2 minutes and 15 seconds, that's more critical, you know, than anything else. So to put a time limit on it, that's the part that bugs me a little bit.
And let me ask you, too, this is probably just, you know, very much a byproduct of the day and age we live in, and social media and everything else. It seems like there's such a heightened microscope on so many things, but particularly in regard to the NBA, but college as well. Like, we know more of these guys' names than we ever have before. Of course, the NBA has so many veteran officials like the players where, of course, everyone knows, you know, Ed Malloy. I mean, you just know who certain guys are because they're personalities as well. But it happens on the college level. But are we just such a social media obsessed culture and what now? I'm just curious, from your point of view, and you'll see it, for instance, at Warriors Rockets game one, like talk about, I mean, there was nothing even really said about the game. It was just like, hey, which side was right about the officiating being horrible, and why are these calls being made and not made? It seems to be the only narrative that you hear. Can you imagine? It's one thing, as you know, on any level, to even call a game at a high school gym with 4,000 fans are equally divided, and you're going to hear it from both sides. And after a long night, right? I mean, you've had enough of that, personal insults, things of that nature. You go home and sleep that off. But can you imagine officiating a game or whatever? And suddenly, later that night, you just look at Twitter and your name's mentioned 10,000 times, and being a trending topic. I mean, I guess what I'm getting at is, have we gotten to where, there's just too much focus on that? I mean, people are just not even, paying attention to the game as much anymore?
Oh, absolutely. From, so for myself as an official, absolutely. You know, that happened to John Higgins a couple years ago, a college official who was thought to be the best for a number of years, still is highly thought of. So he did the Kentucky game. Kentucky lost. The fans called his business. He has a roofing business.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. I mean, they went crazy, right? The guy could not get a call from a customer for 3 days because the Kentucky fans just, as soon they had timetables that they were going to call up and be on their 30 seconds and you were going to call, then the next guy. I mean, that's awful, okay? You go out there and do the best job you can, and again, held to a highest standard. He was in the SEC for any number of years. He doesn't do any SEC games anymore. But Kentucky, he was the reason that he lost. I mean, there's no official in the world that is that good or that bad that costs anybody a game. When you go back and look at all the plays, the missed free throws, the turnovers, again, there is a play at times that contributes to a loss, but there is never a call that solely contributes to that loss. Any coach will tell you that. Now, that time, the coach is emotional. They're not going to tell you that. The day after they go look at that film and talk to their team and look at all the things that they could have done better. And again, officials aren't perfect. None of us are. We don't pretend to be. But I just also know that the coaches and players also have a stake in that as well. And like I said, every coach in the world They may be emotional at the time and tell you that, but the next day when they go back and look at the film, they realize that their team and they themselves have made some mistakes.
Right, and you mentioned Higgins. I'm curious, too. Another one a couple years ago was Ted Valentine, right? Don't they call him TV Teddy or whatever? He'd been around forever. I'm curious, do sometimes the officials' egos work against them? Because there was a series of, let's say, incidents with him where it seemed like, yeah, he seems to kind of like, you know, the spotlight being on himself. But there was one where I know he got in trouble where the player went to ask him something and he turned his back on him. I couldn't believe when they said that, but then I saw a video of it. I'm like, man, there's a point where, you know, I'm all for, like I said, officials being treated as human beings or whatnot. But one thing where I sort of draw the line is, and I guess maybe it's, I don't have that big of an ego myself, especially when I'm officiating, but when they do kind of try to be the show and they're a little bit on the overbearing side, sometimes I sort of, you know what I mean? Sometimes I think they get what's coming to them when it's when that kind of stuff is happening.
No, you're absolutely right. And that happened in the North Carolina game. And, again, you know, me as a human being should be way above that, okay? I want the interest of a coach asking me a valid professional question. I don't have a problem with a young man or a young lady coming up and asking me a question. Now, it's all about the timing, all right? There are certain times to do that. A timeout is a great situation. It's all about the timing to do that. Having said that, Ted Valentine certainly got reprimanded. Since then, he's done a good job, and he's back on the right track. He's had some really good games.
I was going to say, didn't he get demoted a little bit, though? He got taken off NCAA tournament for
absolutely.
A couple of years?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And so the NCAA showed him and everyone else that that was important to them not to do that. Again, it's one thing to say, hey, listen, you know, it's not a good time for us to have a conversation. It's another thing to turn your back on somebody like you just said. I mean, that's not correct. And I shouldn't do that as a high school official. Or any other type of official should do that. Again, there are different times. There are different situations. There's some times that are so great in order to do that. And there's a lot of people that the young man, the young lady, go back and tell their teammates, hey, here's what we need to do. And that's what we're all about, right? If they can communicate that to their teammates, the game's just going to be much better for all of us that way.
Right. Let me ask you this, too, with the training and or feedback that you receive now. I know it's like anything else, right? You get supervisors and people of that nature who grade your performance, and that might be a factor. And if you get to playoff games and things like that, you come together for conferences and learning seminars. And I'm just curious with what you do now and what kind of, you know, feedback are you getting? Are there things every year, are there points of emphasis that are, you know, explained from the rule book? Like, hey, we really want to see, you know, more of this. Do they give your specific feedback? And another thing, you know, there's lots of things that comprise, you know, a quality or a competent official. But, for instance, do you ever get quizzed on just basic rules knowledge? Even stuff that's real funky that you might, oh, the ball bounces up, hits the shot clock and back. The stuff that's like, you know, once in 10 years you might see it. But are those, you know, measures in place, and how is your, you know, grading done?
Yeah, so a bunch of questions there. We'll try to answer them. Whatever I skip, make sure you ask me again because I'm not skipping it on purpose. Let's start off with the testing. So in order for us to officiate high school basketball, and there's certain categories of every official, whether you're a 1 through a 5, okay? So we have to pass a test. We have to pass it to be at the top level with the highest percentage, over 93%, and then it goes down from there. There's also quizzes throughout the year. There's 2-3 quizzes throughout the year. Maybe we just talk about some plays that came up, like you said, that are out of the blue once in a while. But there's always 2 other tests throughout the year with another 25 questions on there. The first test that we have to take is 100 questions. The other thing is evaluations. Yeah, so there's an evaluator that comes out and watches every official, gives them feedback, talks about certain plays with them, and that's how it's done as far as you moving on throughout the playoffs. Just like, excuse me, the college officials. So in order for them to advance each round, they get graded. If they have any sort of hiccup or thing as a crew, individually they get demoted as well. So the 3 of us are working a game, and I've done something wrong. Well, the 2 of you get demoted on me. So it's all 3 of us are having equal part of it. All 3 of us are trying to do the very best job we can. And there were some people last year that if you go look throughout the, you know, there were a lot of people that weren't the normal names advancing because they had some hiccups in some games. And, again, they're evaluated on each and every play. Of course they should be. It's at the highest level. College basketball trying to win a national championship, 1 team out of 332 Division I teams. As for us, again, we're evaluated on a you know, I'm one of the evaluators in the high school association. I get evaluated, and that's how I get the games that I get, whether they be during the playoffs, whether I get a final, whether I move on to the state. That's how it's all done. The biggest critic, Josh, of any official, and you know this from doing it for the time that you did it, is the officials themselves. Okay, any official that's any good at all, he or she brings up things that they did throughout the course of the game. Like I said, these pro guys, they write a report every night. So they write, you know, we didn't do this, we didn't do that. That's why at halftime they bring up, you know, three plays that they want to look at and talk about, because that's going to go on to the second half. Plus, as a crew, there's talk about transparency. I'm bringing up a play that I may have missed. Well, the three of us are going to talk about that. And, of course, we're not going to try to have that same thing bite us in the second half.
All right. Makes sense. We're going to go off to our last commercial break here, so please join us for the last segment. Just a minute. William Hill Sports Show, ESPN 94.5 FM.
Now, back to the William Hill Sports Show, live from the William Hill Sportsbook inside the Club Cal Neva.
All right. Welcome back to the final segment of this week's William Hill Sports Show on ESPN 94.5 FM. Josh Nagel, Mark Shannon with you. Spent the last couple of segments getting Mark's analysis of the state of officiating today's game, because he's an accomplished local official, and we bring him up constantly, well, especially with the recent NCAA tournament, NBA playoffs. We bounced off our ideas a few different times, and Ken Barler had said repeatedly, oh, we need to get Mark on just to have his perspective. Well, he was coming on anyway. We figured now's as good a time as any, because basketball's still been going on, and that was the stuff we wanted to get his perspective on. So thanks, Mark, for your analysis and all that. Moving forward just a little bit with a few more gambling-related topics. There's a few baseball games not only left tonight, but Mark, I'm curious. I know you do a lot of baseball. I know you've had some success with some of the season-long props and things of that nature. What stood out to you so far? Have you found, especially early on in baseball, you know, like the first 40 or so games, we're at about that standpoint now where certain teams are just, you know, over, undervalued. If you jump in there, teams are just not getting enough respect. You can cash in or fade a certain team. Some of the trends stand out to you so far?
Yeah, well, I mean, again, if people have been following it, I'm not telling them anything new, but if you haven't, maybe you can start to watch a little bit. The Padres are off to a tremendous start this year. Their pitching is incredible.
Yeah. And, Mark, by the way, it's funny you mentioned that, which I'll put it this way. It took me a little off guard, because in my job for Sportsland, they had me dig into all this, and, you know, season win totals came out, and they're like, hey, do some research, find out what's going on. And honestly, I'll say this, because it's looking like I'll probably be wrong with this recommendation. But they say, hey, come up with some over-under and do some analysis. And I actually recommended people taking the under on the Padres, because, like, man, to me it just looks like they're rebuilding. But, of course, I just never heard of these guys. I mean, I knew they were highly touted. But it looks like they're scrapping everybody who was basically well-known. Yeah, they're just calling up all these, you know, prospects and sticking them out there right away. Instead, these guys are just killing it. But you kind of saw this coming?
Well, here's what it is. The Padres drafted all of these guys, okay? So for the last 5 years or so, when they've been taking some lumps, and they have certainly taken some lumps, and your under has come through the last 4 years, I believe, with the Padres. But what they did was they drafted all these guys, and they're not the Atlanta Braves when they had Glavin and Smoltz and Avery and all them. But I'm telling you, Josh, they are on the come, and they've got four of the five are left-handed starters on top of it. Andy Green's just done a really good job. I'm not a Manny Machado fan. I thought that he going down there might be a little bit of a detriment.
Right. Do you think it was one of those things where, right, they just wanted to make a little bit of a splash and he was the guy available?
Yeah, you know, and get some more people and get some more fans in there and everything. But I'll tell you what, Eric Hosmer, really like him. The Reyes, the right fielder, talk about a young talent. My goodness, every time this guy's up to bat, he is tough. He's got 15 home runs this year.
He's been on fire.
Yeah. Now, he doesn't have a great average, hitting .255. The Padres are perfectly happy with what he's got going on, because he's got 15 dingers, got a tremendous amount of RBIs. So the Padres are doing really well. And, again, their pitching staff is just really, really good. And on top of their starters, man, they've got three guys in the bullpen. So keep track of the Padres. Again, no secret to anybody. But Tampa Bay, you know, their starters, they keep you under just about.
Killing it.
Keep you under just about every single game. They're not great offensively. They're unbelievable starting pitching. Love their manager. And, of course, when you don't have a great offense and you have good pitching, what does that lead to? Unders, okay? So I'm not telling anybody.
What do you think about that starter by committee thing they do, where they bring in a bunch of relievers in a row?
And you know what? It works for them. Some other teams are now trying it because of the success that Tampa Bay has had. The A's have done that a couple times. Seattle's done it a couple times. Now, no one's done it to the success that Tampa Bay has. But, again, like what they're doing, they for whatever reason, when you can get guys on the professional level to buy into what you're doing as a manager, what you're doing as an organization, you're going to have success. And both the Padres and Tampa Bay, for whatever reason, people are buying in because of their leadership, and they've found some success. So good for those two.
All right, fair enough. Let me ask you a little bit about the San Francisco Giants, where it looks as though they're probably headed toward a bit of another struggling season. Last year for Bruce Bochy, obviously had a heck of a run earlier this decade, right? Three championships. Seems like he's kind of on the end of the line, though, and they appear to be in, I don't even want to say rebuilding, because it doesn't look like doing much to rebuild, just throwing out the same old guys who lost a ton of games last year, as far as I can tell. But tonight, for instance, there's a game, Diamondbacks at San Francisco, 7:15 first pitch, with Robbie Ray of Arizona, the lefty, -125, Drew Pomeranz, new addition to the Giants, +115. They just seem to have some of the same issues they did last year. I mean, I still can't believe it. I often thought, Mark, Jeff Samardzija, still the guy you're throwing out there, like as your third starter, you've probably got some trouble because he appears to be spent. But the rotation, lack of a lot of viable weapons surrounding Buster Posey seems to be an issue. But do you see this being another one where the Giants just, you kind of turn the page, or do you see them maybe coming on a little stronger?
No, I think what you see is what you get. Even Madison Bumgarner, he's struggling, right? I mean, he was unbelievable for those guys. They all were. They, like you said, they had a great run. Having said that, tonight, I have the game under. So I bet under in the first five innings and under for the game. Drew Pomeranz has certainly been struggling. Last time out, he was really, really good. So I'm hoping he can build on that. Robbie Ray, a left-hander, always gives the Giants a little bit of trouble. It's 7 under minus $1.20, 3.5 for the first five. So it's not going to be anything you're going to sit there and want to have some hot dogs and soda pop and be yelling excitement, but you're hoping that it gets them out. And I think we're going to be able to do that in both the first five innings and in the game. You know, Buster Posey, before the season, you talked about, Josh, the props. I mean, his home run total was 10, 12.
Is that right?
It was really, really low. I mean, they kind of knew that this has been going on. And I don't know if that's through the catching, beating himself up a little bit. Physically, he's certainly had some problems, like all people behind the dish. They put him at first base to give him a day off once in a while from catching, to take Brandon Belt's spot against the lefties over there. So, a lot of people saw this coming, and I know some Giant fans that just said, hey, listen, we're not very good. They realized it. But it all starts with pitching in every organization and every team. And again, those guys have been at it long and hard. The bullpen's pretty good. I mean, the last three guys in the bullpen are pretty good, but you got to get to them, and that's their biggest problem.
All right. One other game tonight. A team, for some reason, I can never seem to get on the right side of for the last couple of years. That being the Oakland A's, there are times where I just think it's a good spot to fade them, and they, eat me alive, like the win. Like they just swept, the Indians on the road. But there are times when I back them, and they let me down. So team does that to you enough, and you just say, forget it. I've stopped even trying to handicap Oakland. But tonight, for instance, tell me what you think. Tonight would be a scenario, though, in which I normally find it at least very tempting to fade Oakland, with their home with Daniel Magdy, -158 now, with Wade LeBlanc at +148, who's actually had quite a bit of success against the A's. The A's were swept at Seattle a few weeks back. They win a few games, and to me, suddenly this seems like the price is getting out of hand. I mean, I would only have Seattle here. But as I mentioned, though, I seem to, get Oakland's trajectory wrong a lot. What do you think about what the A's have done so far this year?
So a couple things. The A's, and I don't know when they play the Indians again, but keep it in mind, folks, the A's are 12-1 in their last 13 against the Indians, okay? Would have never guessed that, just like Durant.
Yeah.
So tonight, I mean, I would go against the A's just because of their recent success on the road trip. And you say, geez, why would you do that? Well, the first game back is always one of those things where they're back at home, so they took the kids to school today. The wife said, hey, listen, I've been with the little midgets for the last week and a half. You can do a few things, and now they got to go out and play a baseball game tonight. Whereas when you're on the road, it's what? It's a road trip. You don't have to deal with some of those things. So I would always go against them the first game back after a successful road trip, which they certainly had. The price certainly, like you said. Now, the only thing is Seattle started off this year really, really good. And they have just been...
fell apart. They started with that home sweep with the Red Sox, and they were on fire, and... yeah.
They have just been terrible the last 4 weeks. But the price is certainly right for us to jump in with Wade LeBlanc. Crafty left-hander. You never really, he doesn't throw the ball hard, so you hope that he hits his spots. Because when he doesn't, it can make you look a little silly sometimes. When he's on, he's certainly tough. Crafty, he throws the ball so slow sometimes it throws everybody's timing off. Tonight getting a plus at +148, I could certainly see that. And the other game is the Angels is the last game.
Right, the last one we've got.
Yeah.
What do you think about this, again, even sight unseen, because I know a little bit about this, but the Angels have been putrid. I mean, they just got smoked by the Twins. Their pitching hasn't held up at all. And I understand the Rangers, your Drew Smyly has been a little erratic, but, man, plus 150 on Texas?
So Channing's come up. He's had a little bit of success, a young guy. Matt Harvey's just been terrible. Pitched yesterday.
Yes.
I mean, what a disaster for them. They signed this guy to a whole bunch of money.
I was stunned that, I mean, well, not that he got picked up, but like you said, that, again, a guy who they decided somehow was going to be a mainstay of the rotation for that price.
Yeah, he hasn't done anything. And they've had a bunch of injuries, so they brought this guy up. He's had a little bit of success the last couple times. Again, I don't want the Rangers on most nights. This is a big price. I will probably just stay off the game. Or, you know what, maybe Cannon comes back and gets a couple in a row here for the Angels. But it's nothing. The one game that I bet on tonight, like I said, was I bet under the 3.5 in the first five in the Giant game and under 7 in the total. I'm hoping that Drew Pomeranz gets back at it. And certainly Robbie Ray can be a little bit difficult to handle at times.
All right. Well, I'm just looking real quick, Mark, with the future odds here to win the divisions. A lot of these are still kind of toss-ups, as you'd suspect, this early in the season. But last year we saw this come to fruition with a tight race. I mean, Dodgers right now are minus 15 to win the NL West, and everyone else with these huge odds. Does anyone stand a chance to catch them? The Padres, you just mentioned, are 15-1.
Like the Padres. They're the ones that, they are the ones in that division that can do it.
All right. Well, that just about wraps us up for this week's version of the William Hill Race and Sports Show. Appreciate you joining us. If you haven't already, again, go to williamhill.us and get the mobile app for complete sportsbook at the palm of your hand. You can bet in-game, before the game, and all your future wagers. If you haven't gotten it yet, it's basically the all-purpose betting tool that you need. For Mark Shannon, this is Josh Nagel. Thanks for joining us. See you next week. Same time, same place, ESPN 94.5 FM.